Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Carlucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, retired chief of police and investigator, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Good evening, everybody. Michael Streed is an internationally recognized police sketch artist based in Southern California. His 31-year law enforcement career was paralleled by 30 years of experience as Southern California's most sought-after police sketch artist. In July 2008, he retired as a sergeant with the City of Orange, California Police Department to focus on a full-time career as a police sketch artist and facial imaging consultant. As a police investigator, Michael had the unique opportunity to investigate a host of violent crimes, including rape, robbery, and murder. These types of high-profile crimes help give his art wide exposure. In his role as a police sketch artist, Michael's pencil has led him as far south as San Diego and north to Los Angeles, but his reach was further expanded across the United States when the television show America's Most Wanted asked him to create images for cases they were profiling on their program. As the sketch cop, Michael goes wherever there is a case that requires his special needs. Michael, welcome to the show tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan. I'm thrilled to be here.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your career. What year did you get started in police work, and what different types of assignments did you have during your career?
I started in my police career in 1977 and worked as a police cadet and promoted through the ranks to become a police reserve officer and then on to become a deputy sheriff and then come back to Orange County, where I resumed my municipal law enforcement career, where I worked assignments in field training and patrol as a patrol corporal. As a detective, I worked a variety of assignments in property crimes, thefts, burglaries, major crimes and narcotics, surveillance team, homicide investigation team, sexual assaults, juvenile child abuse. And also, I had the unique opportunity to serve as a deputy coroner in my duties as a deputy sheriff in Santa Barbara County back in the late 70s as well.
Wow. Now, how did you go about with that? I mean, what kind of training did you need for that last assignment?
Well, it was pretty much on the job. At the time, back in the late 70s, they didn't have the formalized training for coroners that they have now. And now, most of them are required to go through anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks of formalized classroom training in addition to the on-the-job training.
Oh, okay. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about how you got involved as a sketch, in the sketch cop, as you're called. Were you one of those kids growing up that was always doodling and all your family would say, wow, you're going to be an artist someday? And did you get those old comic book magazines where on the last page you had to actually draw that picture and send it in to see if you were capable?
You're talking about the TV Guide ad with the little reindeer. You had to redraw the reindeer and get that art scholarship. Now, I was actually that kid that was, doodling during class and was so absorbed in what I was doing, I never realized the teacher was standing over there watching my shoulder and watching my drawing progress to the point, she would finally take it away and make me get focused back on my schoolwork.
So now you're a police officer, and speaking of myself as an ex-cop, I know they always look like police officers, leaders, lieutenants, captains, chiefs. They want to see what your strong suit is. I started working narcotics because I got on so young and I still had a young look. When did they realize your talent and ability to do what you do, or how did you start doing that?
Well, like everyone who has a love of art, we want to find a way to make a living at it. And you realize pretty quickly that unless you're a niche artist or you're really well known, you're probably going to make a meager living and not probably be able to pay the bills as if you had a traditional career. Well, my father was a police officer, and there were always police officers around my house, so I always had a love of helping people, so I became a police officer. But I still had that yearning to create art, and so I was sitting there watching the news one night and saw this composite sketch on the local news and had this epiphany. Went, there it is. That's how I can blend my love of art with my need to, serve the public and be able to marry the two together. So I really just pretty much forced myself on detectives. I would go out and if I heard a place had been robbed, I'd go out and on my own interview the eyewitness, create a sketch, and then bring it back to some dumbfounded detective. The poor guy didn't expect me to do the sketch. And he didn't really know what to do with it.
Can I ask you, has the internet changed, or will it change how sketches are done, or will that always be out there? Because it seems like the internet's taken the place of so many things, including techniques that officers and law enforcement use across the country.
Absolutely not. If anything that technology does, it's going to change the way that sketches are produced. For example, our company, Sketch Cop Solutions, we have produced a...
You actually have a company called Sketch Cop Solutions.
Sketch Cop Solutions, correct. And we not only provide case consultations for agencies that require facial imaging, but agencies that don't have an artist on staff that have to have that composite sketch as evidence, which is every bit as important, if not more important in some cases, than DNA or fingerprints. We've produced a software that allows detectives and law enforcement personnel without artistic talent to be able to use our software to produce high-quality sketch images that looks like they were drawn by myself or another trained police sketch artist.
Is that something... Oh, go ahead.
Michael, I always, when I think of sketch artists, if you ever saw the Steve McQueen movie Bullet, where after the person that's in McQueen's custody or under his protection as a DA's witness is shot in a motel room in a seedy motel. They question the desk clerk at the hotel, and I remember McQueen's assistant is the sketch artist there. Did you ever happen to see that movie?
I have not. I've heard a lot about it, but I have not seen it.
Okay. Well, basically, I think that was probably in the 70s. And the sketch artist has this booklet with all different facial shapes in it and different hairstyles and so on and so forth, the scalp lines, ears, noses, all that kind of stuff. Is that pretty much the same way it is today? Would you go into to interview a witness and have a book with you? Is that how you do it, or that's how it's done, and then the witness would pick the appropriate facial shape and so on?
It's a tool that we all use, and the reason we use that book is because in eyewitness memory and how people remember, there's two parts of memory. There's recall, which is verbal. There's recognition, which is visual. So what happens is when we talk to eyewitnesses, we want to be able to exploit that verbal part of their memory and then reinforce it by showing them pictures from that book. So it not only they tell us how it looks, but they can also show us how it looks. Let me get back also for one moment, and I hope I answer your question, to when we're talking about the software, that there are sketch artists throughout the country, but really highly trained, skilled sketch artists are very hard to find. And I say that because it's all about being able to communicate and be able to get the information from the eyewitness. And one of the reasons for creating the software was because I look at it this way. The police departments need an affordable, effective tool that they can use. And people out there who are the crime victims deserve justice. So if we can give them their justice through providing law enforcement with a viable tool to create faces, then everybody wins. And we use that video, we use that visual reference that you referred to in Bullet, is teaching people how to use that as an element of producing those images within the software as well. So, you know, we use the latest techniques, and I talk regularly with eyewitness experts to be able to, you know, it's like squeezing juice from a lemon, just trying to extract that much more information from their memory to produce an effective sketch.
Michael, question for you. You know, being on the police department almost during those same eras, all through the 70s and late 60s and things like that, let the listeners across the country understand, not only for what you do, but it's amazing now when I look at what's available for the police and even for families. I've had fathers of murdered children show me their online recreations of crime scenes and all the software that is available right now for the police. Let the people know how unique this is. When I look at some of these things nowadays, I could only have imagined this stuff many years ago.
I think that we're moving more towards, obviously a high-tech society, and I think law enforcement is no different. The demands that law enforcement have right now are real-time results type of technology that gives them information quickly, that produces images quickly, that produces crime scene images and measurements quickly. The public has a need to feel safe, and they feel safe by knowing that someone is taken off the street. And when you talk about victims' families, there's that need for closure. There's that need to feel like they're part of something, like they have a way of affecting their case somehow. The nice thing is with police sketches, whether it's done by police sketch artists or software that either the public finds on the internet or the police somehow use, they need to feel a sense of empowerment. And having them in a session drawing a police sketch is probably the one thing I found in police work, the only thing where they can actively participate and help have some sort of effect positively on their case and give them that closure. Because for one, it gives them a chance to confront their attacker for the first time on paper and or computer screen, and they really feel like they're part of something. So it really helps them remain engaged throughout the case. Not that they have any trouble doing that in the first place, but they want to feel part of something, and this helps them do that.
Can a family just contact you? Are they able to just secure services? Maybe police aren't going out and investigating the case, and they come to you or your company and say, can you do this because we need more help? Is that possible?
I have had that, Susan, where I've been contacted by private investigators and or individuals who felt that the police weren't doing enough. And I have to say, being an officer myself, I think when you're on the outside looking at it, it never seems like enough is being done or the cases are being solved quick enough. And when you're talking about large agencies, either they are so busy, it's something that's inadvertently overlooked. Small agencies don't have the resource. But I always listen to people who contact me and evaluate the case. And the one proviso I have is that I partner with law enforcement, that I contact a law enforcement agency, that my being involved is not going to be detrimental to their case. And 9 times out of 10, they're going to say,
can you explain how it could be detrimental?
Well, I think that sometimes that people have personal agendas, and I don't have, when I was a detective, obviously I had most all the information and knew what direction I was going, taking a case in. I don't have that luxury when I'm hired by an outside party and or even when police departments contact me. So really, I've had people contact me with facts that were not necessarily correct, and there was an agenda for them to get me involved or try to drive the case in a direction it probably shouldn't have gone. And I think that, again, law enforcement still likes to maintain that control over the case, as they should, because they're ultimately responsible for prosecuting it. I just like to know that we're all playing on the same team. Bottom line, I'm a team player. We're all reaching the same goal. If an agency says, we already know who it is, we know who this person's talking about, or maybe this person hasn't been as truthful, thank you very much, but no thanks. But most cases say, you know what, we just haven't had time, we don't have the resources. Yes, we welcome you doing that. If they want to pay for it, then, you know, all we ask is we get a copy so we can use it in our investigation.
And Susan, what happens nowadays when I get hired on cases as a private detective now, I always say, if I'm talking to the press or TV or whatever it is, I say that I'm working parallel with the police department on it. I'm not out there to scoop them or do anything of that nature. As soon as I obtain evidence or have anything that's useful, it's turned over to the police department. And just like our guest says, usually 90% of the time it's kind of, well, welcome Vito to the case, we'll work together, call me as you obtain things. Very few times you'll get a police department across the country, but it does happen where they have that, well, we could do it ourselves, why are you even involved in this, don't get in our way attitude. Okay, but most of the time they realize that we're only there, we're hired by the family or we're hired by some agency or whatever it may be. So that's a little more to add to what he said.
And I think,
Michael,
it's important.
Let me ask you a question about how it is when you mentioned that you think in a lot of cases the victims or witnesses who were close to the crime, they get to confront the attacker for the first time on the computer screen or on paper. What is that like? I'm talking about when you're involved or your company is involved dealing with the witness. Are there a lot of emotional issues? I mean, if say a rape victim, for example, how tough is that, if at all, for them to relive through this face that incident? Is it a problem, or no?
It's very different, and I think Susan can probably relate to this very well, being a violence expert that she is, in some of the cases she's involved in. Violence is violence, regardless if it's domestic violence, sexual violence, you know, homicide. Whether it's stranger on stranger, you know, husband on wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, so on and so forth. Regardless of what kind of crime it is, any type of high trauma that you have is going to embed that into memory that much more than if a person was a passive observer. And being able to draw well is one thing, but being able to mine that person's memory for the critical information is paramount in these cases. And you almost, as a police sketch artist, have to be able to separate yourself from that emotional part of it. I mean, I had a case one time where a college kid was carjacked and raped, and she brought her mother in for support, and she was sitting there beside her mother. At one point, I looked up in the drawing, and her mother was cradling her like a baby, and this is a 22-year-old college kid, a grown woman. I looked back at my paper, kept drawing, looked back up. The moment it passed, she's down sitting beside her mother now, and we plunged forward. You have to be able to be sensitive to these people. I'm very much into victims. I'm just very much into that whole being able to give them what they need, because that makes for a better drawing, that powerful emotional connection. I mean, if a person looks at a drawing of a rape suspect that I've drawn and they get physically ill and excuse themselves from the room and vomit and or cry and shake uncontrollably, to me, I know that we've got a good sketch that's going to be something useful to the police. Very, very powerful.
There was that crime out in Illinois. It happened where it was at a Lane Bryant store. It was a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. And they had killed, you know, five women, and it was that sketch was what was so helpful because of his braids,
mm-hmm.
The specific braids that he had.
You're always looking for something distinct. Yep, you're always looking for something distinct that's a signature of that person's face. Caricature artists, for example, are very, very good at catching those signatures. Say, for example, let's talk celebrities, since everyone's familiar with celebrities mostly. Jimmy Durante, if you saw Jimmy Durante's nose, you'd know it belonged to him. You know, Marty Feldman's, you know, Popeyes. Those are those things that every one of us have something that's unique, that sets us apart from someone else.
But you don't think of cornrows. This guy had cornrows that were specific to a beauty shop somewhere, and that's where the police concentrated on. You don't think of that, though, but you would.
I would. And the reason I say that is because I get facial reconstruction cases sometimes where we have nothing more than a skull. And I remember one case back in the early 90s where they dug up a couple skulls that had been buried since 1978, both murder victims. And they were wearing Harley Davidson T-shirts and motorcycle garb, you know, like it was something that's indicative of an outlaw motorcycle club member. And I had to somehow do some sort of personality profile, image profile on how I would think their hairstyle would look for that era and that type of lifestyle. And it wound up being dead on. So sometimes you have to be almost, you have to know a little about everything to be able to properly profile the image.
So you can profile the CrimeWire team members from 30 years ago and do it in that era. That would be kind of cool. We could put that on the website.
Yeah, and I think the web, and I think the web's really good for a lot of things these days, especially getting images out there.
It is.
Yeah, Michael, we hear today a lot about, of course, you know, the CSI programs and all that, and the DNA and so forth. I think that gets the bulk of the attention now, but sketches obviously can be very critical in solving cases. Do you have any stats or any specific cases you'd like to mention where a sketch played a key role in the apprehension of the suspect?
Well, let's talk about, you know, you made good mention of DNA and the whole CSI effect, and we've come to rely in law enforcement on positive ID types of CSI, like fingerprints and DNA, where you've got a structure or formula that positively matches it. Sketches are subjective evidence. However, in the Samantha Runyon case in 2002, we had a 5-year-old girl that was taken off the street by a stranger. The only witness was a 5-year-old playmate of hers. And although the suspect left a ton of DNA, tire track, fingerprint, just a ton of evidence, his DNA was not in the system. He wasn't in CODIS. He had no prior convictions, nothing. So the sketch played a critical role in solving the case, because once we sat down and produced the sketch and they aired it in the media, within 48 hours, two different people who named the same suspect, he was apprehended, taken into custody, swabbed, and his DNA matched that found at the crime scene. He's sitting on death row right now, and that's the best example I can think of where you don't have DNA, you don't have fingerprints, but you have a sketch, and that is the linchpin. That's the key that unlocks the door that makes it able for all these other experts and detectives to do their job and make that positive match now.
How do you do children? How do you do age-wise when somebody comes to you and they've seen something and they're traumatized? Are you able to work with different age groups easier than others?
You know, no, not really. You have to be able to adapt, and a good sketch artist will be able to adapt their communication style, their language style, the way they dress, the way they posture and hold themselves, depending upon the eyewitness or age of the victim, stature in the community, a lot of other things. So 5-year-olds, my two biggest cases have been 5-year-old, 8-year-old, and 10-year-old witnesses. And
What about the Laura Bradbury case? Yeah, that was interesting, because that was a kidnapping and a murder.
They don't know, in fact, if it was a murder. They found fragments of what they believed to be her skull. And they still don't know to this day if she wandered away from the campground or was abducted. I know I did a sketch in that case along with another artist from San Bernardino County, and they were adult eyewitnesses in that case. I can tell you, adults and law enforcement officials are oftentimes too quick to dismiss a child eyewitness. And I can tell you, in my most successful cases, the eyewitnesses have been young children. And if you can get down on the floor and talk to them and play with them and enter their world, you can be very, very successful. So I look at the different ages I have of eyewitnesses, the different community statures, the different language skills. I look at all that as being a challenge.
And Michael, question for you. Yeah. I think our listeners would like to know your starting point on this. Going back to when you had won those awards, I think 1996 American Legion Award, United States Congressional Certificate of Recognition. Uh-huh. I believe for that case you spoke about before with the two bodies that were buried for over 17 years. When you get a case like that, where is your starting point when somebody's buried for that long amount of time? Now, I mentioned that this is the case you mentioned before about the Hell's Angels shirt. Am I correct?
Right.
Huh?
Yeah,
where do you go from there? Where's your starting point? What was your starting point on that?
In that case, the starting point was the picking up the skulls from the coroner's office and having that physical evidence in front of me to be able to look at in terms of starting to visualize what the facial structure might have been. And after that, I take a look at the crime report, the evidence reports, the odontology reports, the anthropology reports, the autopsy protocol. I look at all the reports and all the evidence that's found so I can find clues that might help with this person's visual identity.
And when your finished product, were they able to determine from your finished product who the two people were?
They were. It was really kind of funny because when I gave the drawings to the coroner's investigator, he looked at me and said, well, I don't know what good these drawings are going to do. They both look alike. And I said, well, maybe they're brothers. That was the last thing I said before I walked out of the coroner's office. And next thing, 2 months later, I'm getting a phone call from the Orange County Register saying, hey, how do you feel about these brothers being identified? I called the reporter back. I said, first of all, how'd you get my unlisted number? I said, number two. I said, what brothers? And they told me the story about what had happened and the fact that they were brothers. And two people actually independent of one another saw the sketches in the Riverside Press Enterprise newspaper, recognized them from the sketches as well as the physical description, the clothing description, called the names,
wow.
And they used dental charts to match. The nice thing was with that case, not only did law enforcement have a second look at that case, but it also gave the girlfriend and one of the victim's children some closure because that child grew up not knowing if his father was dead and kept – every time his girlfriend said – every time that door opened, he thought it was his dad coming through the door. And now he knows that his father's dead, and they could give him a decent burial and take care of that end of it personally.
Michael, I'm just curious. I don't imagine this happens, but I just wanted to ask you, do you ever get a situation where the victim or a witness refuses to cooperate or is uncooperative? And if so, what are the circumstances with that? What would cause that if it ever happens?
Well, I actually had a case where there was a murder involving a couple of gang members who were the eyewitnesses. One of the gang member eyewitness's brother was gunned down in the streets here in the Inland Empire in Southern California. And the officers introduced me to him. They all three of us in a room. They sat there slouching their chairs. They didn't want to say anything. So remember, they wanted to get out of that police station so they could hit the streets and blood on blood and exact revenge. And I said, look, guys, I worked in gangs. I worked the gang unit. I know the code. I know what you want to do. But today is not going to be the day. And I talked them through it, and they helped me create a sketch that led to the shooter's arrest within 2 hours of the sketch being completed.
Wow. That's impressive.
I mean, you have to be able to talk. That's the whole thing. People are always willing to show you their pretty drawings. But I could certainly draw pretty drawings all day, but it's about being able to get down with these folks and talk to these people, build that bridge of trust, and just communicate and work hard and make them part of the team, make them part of this whole process.
Look, can I ask you another question?
Sure.
I hesitate to admit this, but I'm going to. Somebody in the chat room said earlier that they can't draw a straight line. I have to admit I'm in the same boat, and I know that. But if I had your software, in spite of my artistic handicap, would I be able to do anything, or do you have to have at least a certain amount of skill?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. All you would need is the ability to know how to use a computer and be able to communicate with people, to be able to do an interview, to be able to produce a sketch-quality image using our software without a stitch of artistic talent.
But you have to know how to use a computer, is that right? And you have to be able to work your way around it to be able to work the program?
Well, if you can use a mouse and you know how to click a mouse and a Windows-based programs and such, it's a snap because it is
really?
A Windows-based program. It has the drop-down menus. It has the icon point and click. I mean, we even put on 2-day training courses, you know, teaching law enforcement and, you know, other folks on how to use the software and how to produce sketches using the software, realizing that either they're either in the law enforcement realm or they're hoping to be employed as a CSI or an investigator someday. And because we want our software to become the standard software for police, we want to teach them how to use it. So absolutely.
How much does the program cost?
We encourage, well, it's very cost effective for law enforcement. If any law enforcement listeners are out there, they can, you know, contact me via our website, www.sketchcop.com, or email me, michael@sketchcop.com. I'd be glad to give a quote.
Okay, because I just thought maybe you'd offer it to one of us so that we could test it and say how wonderful it is.
Well,
Michael Street, we are.
We can certainly arrange it off the air. Okay.
Okay. Michael Street, we are out of time. Give us your website again, please, sir.
www.sketchcop.com. And if people want to contact me, the Sketch Cop, Michael Street, personally, they can do so, michael@sketchcop.com. I can also be contacted on Facebook, Michael W. Street. And I look forward to anybody contacting me who may need some assistance either in the law enforcement world or that has a private case and or would be interested in the software. I will talk to anyone that has any questions.
Thank you, sir.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Vito. Thank you, Danny. And thank you, Susan, for having me on your show.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take it away, Mr. Denny.
Yes, tonight for our second segment, we're going to go back 64 years to March 19th, 1947, talk about the disappearance and murder of 12-year-old Edward Flynn, Jr. in Burlington, Massachusetts. Jane Cervantes of Citizens Against Homicide and Eddie's brother, John, will take us through what happened to Eddie and who may have been responsible for his death. Gene and John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Denny.
Thank you, Denny. Hello.
And before we get started, I understand, John, that you have a little background on the case prepared that you'd like to read to us. Do you have something you'd like to share with us to start with?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Denny. Vito Colucci and Susan Murphy Milano, thank you all from CrimeWire for allowing the presentation of the Little Eddie Flynn case. Thanks also to Gene Cervantes and Citizens Against Homicide for their assistance in this review. 64 years ago, 12-year-old Little Eddie Flynn lost his dreams, his aspirations, and his life when he left our home on Harriet Ave, Burlington, Mass., to attend CYO band practice at St. Joseph's Church Hall in Medford, Mass., where he used to attend school. 3 days later, his body was found 8 miles away in the woods of Billerica, nude except for his shoes and socks, his midriff covered by his brown leather jacket, the victim of a sexual predator. For those 64 years, you could say justice has been denied. For those 64 years, not a person, a policeman, a priest, a worker, an athlete, or a warrior, but a wretched human being slipped away into those many nights and days to pursue whatever sadistic cruelty pleased him. In those same 64 years, we, his family, didn't have the pleasure of Eddie's presence at a birthday, a graduation, a wedding, a speech, a sermon, or a concert. None of these things could we share, but his spirit keeps us alive. It's why we pursued this case. It is the flicker that can open our eyes, warm our hearts, and pause to always remember that shining young brother proudly playing his clarinet. Now, this case has been an enigma to our family, and particularly our parents, since its tragic occurrence in 1947. Mom and Dad suffered through not only Eddie's loss, but the repeated fruitless attempts to see process in the investigation, find any information on the case, or return of Eddie's personal items. We as children suffered through similar frustration and for some time have sought to have a lot of those questions answered. The case solved or some explanation of what was done or not done and what records do exist. About a year ago, we decided to pursue the case through the internet and began seeking news clips. A source in law enforcement that might have records or case files and evidence pertinent to it. Eventually, traveling this media vehicle, I was able to reach Lieutenant Detective Tom Sullivan of the Mass State Police, Case File Section, Department of Public Safety in Middlesex County, Woburn, Massachusetts. I also reached out to Citizens Against Homicide for assistance and some ability to focus on this case, and thanks to them, we arrived at this forum. Through my contact with Detective Tom Sullivan and numerous emails and communications to and fro, we reached the following conclusions. There is an existent file on the Eddie Flynn case at Tom's case file division. It contains no evidence. It contains no prime suspect. The Billerica Police Department, which was the staging office for the state police during the search and investigation in 1947, contains no records or files of this case. The State Police Crime Lab, which Tom referred the inquiry to, in its search for any evidence or records, found nothing. This means that perhaps the only hint of evidence we have is the newspaper clippings that we got from my parents and most from the Boston Herald Library. I was told also that of the belief that Massachusetts has a statute that requires them to keep case files for only 50 years. No security is required for these files. The evidence that I assumed was in the file, which was at the crime scene, has vanished. And that kind of is what I have so far in talking with Detective Sullivan. And that's kind of... And I always assumed that these things that were found at the crime scene that were the case file, it's kept until the case is solved. I mean, and you can't have access to it because they're holding it for evidence.
Denny and Vito, that's a whole other show, isn't it, of what is kept over a period of time.
Yeah, you have different policies that vary by police departments. If I do a criminal check on an individual, nationwide criminal check, depending on the police agencies, let's say some of them keep only their records for a matter of 7 years, which doesn't make any sense to me. And then, you know, they go up to 10 or 15 other jurisdictions, as well as some agencies like the FBI keeps them forever. But, John, let me ask you this question here. Why don't you explain to our listeners a little bit more about this headline that I read, "Remorse Leads Sex Killer of Flynn Boy to Suicide." This Eugene Leroy Leach, which supposedly took his life by carbon monoxide in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and supposedly left a suicide note or something of that nature. What do you feel about that?
I just don't have a feeling that Eddie took a ride from somebody. This is the understanding that I have. I mean, and from my parents, he wouldn't take a ride with somebody unless he knew them. Now, this person, there doesn't seem to be any identification between him, the crime scene, the event that happened, other than he worked on a farm within a few miles of where his body was found. He was not in any way tied to the band, the school. In looking through it, now, I don't know. Maybe he has some connection, but there's no note that says anything about what crimes he committed. There's no evidence saying he said he did this. He just killed
Gene Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide. Is there a way, because of your organization and your agency, what you do across the country, is it possible to take and get something done in the legislation so that no matter what, if a case is not closed and it's still unsolved, that they cannot destroy, they cannot, you know, it's got to be preserved?
I don't know. We've never had a case this, this old, 64 years. When John first reached out to us, I kind of looked at this with a jaundiced eye, and I thought, oh my God, you know, I was only 2 years old when this happened, and
I was five.
Yeah, and I thought, okay, let's try. And so I suggested to John to go to certain agencies, and lo and behold, he came back, and he called me back and says, I've got a contact. They do have evidence. They do have files. And then he started talking about files were lost and evidence was lost. And I couldn't believe it. I was dumbfounded because my understanding has always been cases are open for life, you know.
And I was told that...
murder cases, that is.
That the in the process of moving five times, wherever they keep these files, it moved five times in those 64 years, some things get lost. So a few files get lost. And I'm saying, well, I don't know. That really sounds weird. I mean... How can you just lose whole files?
But I think, Denny, don't, and you would agree or not agree, but I think that if we did something almost as far as a shout-out in some way, we would find, just like the medical examiner office cases, we would find cases across the country where evidence has been lost by, you know, not so old the cases are, but more current ones, that evidence has been lost. What do you think?
Well, I agree, sir. Before I get into that, because I'm ready to go on a rant, but before I get into that, I want to thank John. You know, we deal with a lot of cold cases on the show here.
Yeah.
Some of them go back 20, 30 years. This 64 years for the family to still have an interest, to have kept at it for 64 years, my hat goes off to you that you've had the fortitude to continue the fight, trying to get justice and trying to find out what exactly happened to your brother and at whose hand. So my compliments to you for that. And I, you know, one of the things that was in evidence supposedly at one time here were a lot of scrapings taken from under Eddie's fingernails.
That's correct.
Now, granted, maybe back in 1947, no one was thinking about CSI at that point. However, as we know now, that if a suspect were ever found, or if someone was in the system now who was arrested later for a different crime and got into the system, had that DNA been available, it may have contributed to solving or getting an answer on this case. And if that DNA is gone, which I, my understanding from what you said, it is gone, that's really a tough pill to swallow. It's just a rotten shame if everything is gone. It really.
Yeah, because it was like even things like the clarinet case, the leather jacket, his clothing, and the clarinet case had a thumbprint on it. They also had tire track casts made of the vehicle that was in the lane. They don't have those. I mean, those are things that they made themselves. And I imagine they're fairly good size. You know, just saying that I could see some things missing, but I would think that wouldn't there be one or two items still there? Or,
yeah, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe Vito sees it differently, but then, of course, I was involved in law enforcement substantially later on. But
yeah.
Evidence had to be cataloged, had to be property receipts, and especially a murder case, my God. And where stuff went to and who had it and why they had it and why it was moved from one place to another. All that stuff had to be documented. Vito, am I correct? I don't know, unless I was in a unique department, but there had to be a paper trail and evidence had to be accounted for.
Yeah, that is correct, Denny. What I see what happened on this, my opinion is what happened is either one of two things. Either the least likely scenario was that somebody got rid of it on purpose because they knew somebody or something of that nature. But the most common thing, and I see this all the time, especially when police departments move, I see them do this with warrants. If a warrant is 25 years old, let's say, of course not on a murder thing, but they toss them when they move. I can picture them finding this box of whatever was there on this case and asking the captain or asking the chief, what do you want me to do with this stuff? Well, how long does it go back? Yeah, it goes back to 1947. All right, toss that one. I mean, I can tell you that happens more times than not.
Would they do it, Vito, if, let's say, the Black Dahlia, look at that case, 1947, they've preserved everything. In this case, there was no media, really, not a lot of attention. in the Black Dahlia, you had, you know, the world kind of picked it up. Is there a difference maybe back then as to how a case was fueled by the media, where they might have just tossed it and said it just doesn't have any, you know, any benefit anymore because nobody's paying attention?
Well, yeah, don't forget now, too. That's, you know, before television, basically, and everything else, where something would be a big nationwide event, especially for a young kid like this going to CYO or whatever he was doing. But, you know, it's a type of situation. Obviously, from what Denny was saying before, if they had kept this, if they had kept this with these scrapings under the nail and different things that they did have on it, obviously, nowadays, they could have tested it all, go through the database, and even if they found out that Joe Smith did it, and he passed away 10 years ago, even if that DNA, Joe Smith was in jail, they find out that his DNA was taken in jail, oh my God, it matches here, but he died, at least the family has a end result of it, you know?
But do we know if DNA back then or all those years ago when it wasn't tested correctly, doesn't it have to be preserved a certain way before that it sustains all those years? If it's not properly sealed and captured, who knows if that DNA would have even accounted for anything to anyone?
Yeah, that's a good point. Somebody like Dr. Michael Bodden would make a comment on that. Many times on a case of that nature, when a body's found from 35, 40 years ago or, you know, whatever, he may say sometimes that, no, there's nothing valuable there at all, even if it was found. That could be the opinion on this case, too, because this is 64 years old, you know?
Well, one of the things that, excuse me, my parents, they used to, up until 1960, I think, they kept inquiring and asking about if they could get any of the personal effects back, and they'd tell them that you couldn't have access to them because the case was still open. Now, that was up until 1960, so that told me that there was evidence there. But now, then you hear that there's no evidence at all. You know, it's just a contradiction there. But they told them that, well, the case is still open, you know.
Gene Cervantes.
Yeah.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that when this case first reached you, you looked at it with, I think you said, a jaundiced eye. And I got to admit, I did too. I more or less scanned the information, and I said, oh my God, they know who did it. They, you know, the guy killed himself before they could arrest him or whatever. But it looks like the case was closed. And again, that was a scan job. Then I started reading the information a little more closely. And this Leach individual, who the police seemed quite confident was the killer, he had a sexual arrest for sexual conduct when he raped a girl, 16-year-old girl. And he did a couple of years for that, and he was, of course, had the record as a sex offender. He states, according to the information in the newspaper, that he wrote a letter to his wife shortly before his suicide. This is supposedly the suicide note, I guess, or the information the police relied on, that it was a confession. And he tells his wife, I have come here to think things out. I am using the assumed name of Ian Korvetsky. I put myself at the mercy of a psychiatrist to determine whether or not I am a sex pervert. I told him everything about myself. He determined I was, that the chances of my cure for sex perversion are remote. He advised me to return to Massachusetts and give myself up. He said I might be put in an institution where I could harm nobody, but I'm going to rid the world of a danger and escape my subconscious. And he also said he was particular bad things he had done that the police were not aware of. Well, as I read that and thought about it a little more, I'm thinking if I, you know, you'd have to think if he sexually assaulted and murdered a 12-year-old boy, would he need a psychiatrist to find out if he had a problem? I would think he would have known that. I don't think he would need a psychiatrist telling that. I'm wondering, and his previous victim, at least the one we know about where he was convicted, was a female. A little older, a 16-year-old, and he says that things he did that the police didn't know about. Well, they certainly knew about Eddie.
Right.
So, you know, they were investigating the murder, so I'm not convinced that this so-called confession or indication of guilt was specific to Eddie Flynn's case. Gene, am I reading that
bunch.
Right, or do you see it differently, or what are your thoughts?
Who's trying to comment? Is that you, John?
Were you asking me?
No, I was asking
Gene, but why don't you let Gene go ahead, John, and you can follow him and give your thoughts.
You know, normally, it's been my experience that there's no crossover with sex, you know, gender. You find a sex offender who preys on young girls. You find a sex offender that preys on young boys. They don't cross over normally. I've been in, 30 years in the prison system, so in the classification process, so I see these files on sex offenders all the time. And I was thinking, what does the autopsy say? And John can maybe speak to this better than I, but because all I got from them was cause of death was asphyxiation, but I never did see an autopsy report. It could have been one of the documents that was missing or lost, and the technology advances in DNA testing. Even the degraded DNA can be tested and get some results, and today it's meticulously protected and stored, cataloged, whatever they do with the DNA and how they store it. Back then, they didn't even know what DNA was. Somebody says DNA, oh, yeah, who's the initials of who?
I really don't know, Denny.
Maybe John can shed some light on that.
Okay, go ahead.
It's in one of those newspaper articles. The coroner's report did say that it was asphyxiation, and he died like 24 hours. He had only been dead 24 hours, and they found him on the 20th at 10 a.m. So he would have had to have, it comes out to, he would have had to have died at 10 a.m. on the 20th, because they found the body on the 21st, I think, according to all these articles.
Okay.
So that means that 10 a.m. he was still alive, according to the coroner, if you read that article. And the other thing is, I'm kind of missed this guy that lived on the farm, or wherever he was, that this Leech character. In other words, he would have had to go to Burlington to pick Eddie up, wherever they say that he got in a car with somebody. So he would have had to have been in Burlington on the 19th to take him, as that's according to the newspaper articles. But I just don't see a lot of crossover to him and Eddie, and he just seems like he was a guy that worked on the farm, and he had a record of of attacking females, and I guess he has one rape conviction. But I mean, it's possible it was him, but it just seems like it looks like a shot in the dark that they were trying to throw a name in there, and you don't have to look any further.
So you agree with me then that you don't necessarily think this letter from Leech to his wife was a confession to Eddie's murder?
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't believe it. It was.
I think they would have mentioned it to him, like you said, when they questioned him. They would have tried to get something out of him about Eddie Flynn. You know, about that particular case. They would have approached it a little different.
And am I correct that the police launched some massive effort trying to find this psychiatrist that Mr. Leech mentioned in his letter? Now, I didn't see anything where they ever found this psychiatrist. Do you know anything about that, John or Gene? Was this psychiatrist ever located?
As far as I know, he wasn't. All I got is these newspaper articles, but they never did talk with a psychiatrist, according to the articles. But one of them says there was only two psychiatrists in that area, so I don't know, wouldn't you just go to the two people?
In the county there, right there? That's all there were? Two?
In that county, yeah.
You're going
it's
back to 1947,
to
Susan. So.
Yeah, but it's also interesting to me, and this is something from me doing this AMC, the Unsolved that I was part of, which were the older cases and the Zodiac and the Alphabet and the cases from the 40s and the 50s. I found it interesting that back then as well, you found the victims. They weren't buried. The families were able to at least locate them, even though the cases weren't solved. But then it seemed like when DNA started to be a factor in catching these criminals, that these criminals were more advanced in hiding and non-recovery of the body. I see more of that. It seems like it's more prevalent now. We can't find the bodies. We're out there looking for the remains. But during that time period, that the killers, it seemed like they didn't bury deep or they didn't bury at all, and they allowed the families at least to find them.
And
that
that's not unlike the ones who graduate from sexual assault to actual murder because they don't want to be identified. It's the same concept. It's unbelievable that this has taken this long and still unsolved. And
but how many are there? There's got to be. I think, John, are you computer savvy?
Oh, me? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I think you should put up a website, perhaps, or a site where people could go and just ask, almost like they did for Justice of the Dead, as a unique kind of a project, and maybe Gene can help too, that to put this up there and ask for cases between a certain time period and ask if the cases have been solved and kind of band together perhaps to, A, create awareness, and B, obtain some sort of a justice so that this doesn't happen down the road in other cases.
Yeah.
Well, and then the fact that, speaking to the point that Denny was hitting on, if the confession of the note was an actual believable confession, the case would have been closed. The authorities would have closed the case. They would have had a hearing, noted, okay, it's closed.
They didn't do that.
No. That's why I would agree with John that Leach didn't do it. But, that's just a layman's opinion. And as far as the publicity, there was gobs of publicity in the Boston area only. I don't think there was national news such as the Black Dahlia.
No, not on this. The only thing that happened with this case was my father's best friend worked for the Record American, and he was a photography editor. And the case did gain a lot of publicity in Boston because of that, because he kind of got the newspaper behind it, and he did a lot of reporting and photographing. And, well, that's why I went to the Traveler, because I knew that
is yeah.
paper that it, owns the Record American, or the old papers. That's it.
Yeah, and it's our hope that somebody would grab this and take it nationally. Some of the more popular shows, more funded, well-funded shows could take this nationally and do what they can.
What about a university, guys? Why not present this to one of the universities? I'm sure that they would take it. This would be fascinating, where
project,
they could maybe the cold case unit in Atlanta, maybe Tom Shamshak himself. I mean, there's a lot of places you could do and take this case to that they would work on. I would suggest that you consider that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a good option. Well, I mean, at least if nothing else, I've reached these conclusions that for all these years I thought there was some evidence there, because the way that they were so protective about telling anything to my parents. My brother tried a few times to get through to the state police and find information, and they were very protective of everything. He couldn't even talk with them. And I think the internet helped a little bit, because I could look
it
up.
It helps a lot, John.
Yeah, and going through the departments in the state police and the DA's office, that's how I was able to get to that particular office through the Department of Safety, National, And I found it that way. But it was for so long, it seemed to be like you couldn't approach them about it. You know, it's just strange.
Yeah, and it was my hope that we could get this out there, like on this show, and people call in with some suggestions. And
Yeah,
that sounds good.
212-675-2254. If anybody has any suggestions, or again, I think a website would be a cool thing, and maybe we could even link it back to us and start gathering this information on these cases. All right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you
and
to the Crime Wire team.
I'd like to give my email if anybody has any information. They could cahvadvocate@yahoo.com.
And Gene Cervantes is on our CrimeWire site, so please, it's an excellent resource. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, April 5th, 2011.
Can I give
Tune
my
in
email
as we continue. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.